program. And as you know, CRIC sponsors with the Central Asian Studies program a series of lectures dealing with Central Asia. And we definitely consider this one a good example. So I'm delighted this afternoon to welcome Kelly McMahon, who is an associate professor in the Department of Political Science at Case Western University. She graduated as an undergraduate from Dartmouth College, and then from the she did her PhD in the Department of Political Science at the University of Michigan. She's been a visiting scholar at the Davis Center at Harvard University. She's also taught at Wellesley College and Yale University. She's the author of a book, Economic Autonomy and Democracy, Hybrid Regimes in Russia and Kyrgyzstan, published by Cambridge University Press. On her departmental website, it says that she's currently conducting research on three topics: corruption, political legitimacy, and Islam. And it's kind of tough to do them all together, so I assume they're discrete projects. And obviously, your talk is related to one of these topics. She's writing a book entitled Grand Plans and Petty Corruption, Adapting to the Market in Post-Communist Countries, which explores why citizens use bribes, personal connections, and promises of political support to obtain government assistance. And so she has some publications on this topic already, including an essay in the volume Everyday Life in Central Asia. And she has another project where she's exploring why mosques and other Islamic institutions provide social services in some Muslim societies, whereas in others they do not. So her work is very rich in several different areas. And rather than listening to me talk about it, I would be happy to ask you to welcome Professor McMahon, who will be talking about grand plans and petty corruption, adapting to market reform in Central Asia. And on your way out, don't forget to pick up copies of the CRICA flyers of events. So, Professor McMahon, thank you very much for coming.
Thank you for the introduction. Thank you all for coming, and thanks also to CRICA and the Central Asian Studies Program for inviting me to speak about my work. I look forward to your comments today and your suggestions. During the past 15 years, when I spent time living with families in Central Asia and other post-communist countries, and also conducting interviews in those countries, it became clear to me that the greatest impact of the collapse of the Soviet Union on average citizens was the demise of the Soviet welfare state. So the end of all those extensive benefits and the end of the state's prominent role in the economy. This is particularly true in those post-communist, including Central Asian countries, that have undertaken market reform. Market reform meaning privatization, liberalization of prices, and deregulation. So in those countries, the states pulled back from the economy even more. Today, what I'm going to talk about is one way that people have coped with this withdrawal of the state from their lives. And that is, people use bribes, personal connections, and promises of political support to try to obtain goods and services from their government officials. The story I'm going to tell you today also has a broader resonance, and that is, it offers a new way to think about corruption. So the framework I offer suggests that citizens consider alternatives to corruption before choosing to engage in corruption. So neither the absence of legal sanctions, nor the demands of government officials, nor culture automatically propel citizens into corrupt exchanges. Instead, they make decisions about when to engage in corruption. And I'm going to argue today that they engage in corruption when they find that market actors, such as private banks, and societal actors, such as Islamic institutions, can't provide the goods and services that they need. Now, this turning to corruption is even more likely under the certain conditions of market reform. So I'll talk about that as well today. So basically, we'll see that the grand plans of market reform can promote petty corruption through people's decisions about how to adapt to that market reform in Central Asia. And by petty corruption, I'm talking about citizens trying to gain basic goods and services that they need. This is interactions between just average citizens and low-level bureaucrats, okay? Whereas often we talk about grand corruption, which is between the oligarchs and top government officials. so people are at higher levels and for bigger stakes. Now, focusing on petty corruption is really important for a number of reasons, and it's been largely ignored by other scholars. Petty corruption is a means to cope with economic hardship, so it can help us understand how people survive economic transitions. It also has many negative consequences, we think. It can reduce regime legitimacy, it can increase political and economic inequality, and it can also lead to the growth in economic inefficiencies. This argument about the importance of petty corruption and the impact of market reform isn't just specific to Central Asia. For three decades now, in every region of the world, we've seen market reforms being undertaken. So this argument can have broader implications as well. And as Yuli mentioned, this project is part of a book manuscript. Also, I published a part of the argument in Comparative Political Studies, which was the article was published last summer, if you're interested in looking at that later. So what I'm going to do is, first of all, elaborate on the argument, provide evidence from Central Asia for the argument, and then finally talk about the broader theoretical and policy implications. So the basic causal argument I'm making is that market reform under certain conditions can promote corruption. Okay, so this argument includes two conditions and a causal factor. The first condition that's needed in order for market reform to promote corruption is a legacy of major state economic intervention. So what I mean by that is government officials either outright ban non-state actors, non-government officials, from engaging in economic activity, or they grant monopoly rights. So they say that only a few people in society can be involved in economic activity. In either case, this leads to a scarcity of goods and services in society, in the market. Instead, it's the government that's providing them. Then you introduce market reform, the causal factor. When you introduce market reform and suddenly the government's saying, okay, you can go ahead and engage in economic private economic activity, what this means is, first of all, that those new market actors, those new private banks, for example, are starting from scratch. They don't have experience, they don't have resources to a large extent. It also means that as a result of market reform, the state has been scaled back. State goods and services are reduced dramatically as part of market reform. Now, in theory, by proponents of market reform, this shouldn't be problematic. Creating market reform should generate all these market opportunities. But what we see in practice is a lot of times we don't have the next step, which is effective market building institutions. And market building institutions are rules, enforcement mechanisms, and organizations that transmit information, enforce property rights and contracts, and manage competition. So basically, they're institutions that government officials create in order to help the flourishing of the market. And two concrete examples of these are credit registries, so databases where credit information about the, or credit worthiness information about the population is on record for private banks to use. Another example is anti-monopoly committees, where the government encourages competition by trying to reduce monopolies. So when you have these two conditions and this causal factor market reform, this leads to resource-poor non-state actors. So I've already described how market actors, when you introduce market reform under these conditions, are starting from scratch. If you don't have the effective market building institutions, it's very difficult for them to operate. These conditions and this causal factor also have an effect on societal actors, such as mosques and secular charitable associations. For those, societal actors need donors. So they need the market to be thriving in order for a greater percentage of people to become wealthy and be willing and able to give money as donations. Finally, these conditions and the causal factor have an effect on families, but the effect is differential on families. Some families, in fact, do become better off under these conditions and in the context of market reform. But we've seen, particularly throughout the Soviet Union, that initially under these conditions, a lot of families are impoverished. Okay. Now, without market or societal actors to turn to for basic state goods, citizens will turn to corruption. They have few formal programs left to obtain state goods and resources. Societal and market actors are resource poor, so what they do is they go to government officials and they say, look, I know you're not really in this business anymore of credit or subsidies or guaranteeing employment, but how about if I give you a little extra money? Can you create something for me? Or come on, you know my uncle, can't you help me out? Okay, so that's the type of corruption we're talking about. Now, the evidence I'm going to present today, or the evidence I've collected for this project, is on three different tiers. First of all, I have evidence from Central Asia, then I have evidence from a collection of post-communist countries, and then from the developing world. Today, I'm going to focus on the evidence for Central Asia because it illustrates the causal argument nicely. Also, Central Asia is really a critical case for this argument. So at the time that market reform was introduced into the region, in some of the countries of the region, there was also a proliferation in mosques and other Islamic institutions and in secular charities. So a lot of observers of the region said, well, that's fine, the state's pulling back, because now mosques are going to fill the void. Secular charities are going to fill the void. They're going to meet people's needs. Okay? But what I'll show today is, in fact, that this didn't happen in terms of those other actors fulfilling the needs. All right? And so what was going on in Central Asia suggests that this would be a really hard place to illustrate the argument, but in fact, it is possible to illustrate it. So let's move to the Central Asian case.
I'm aiming it more at the computer.
Oh, computer. Makes sense. Okay. All right, so let's go through the argument and talk about Central Asia in particular. So first of all, as we all know, in Central Asia, there's definitely a legacy of significant state economic intervention. So the Soviet party state owned the means of production, distributed capital, set prices, directed labor, and produced goods and services. So the state was very, very involved in the economy. All right, and that we know from historical sources. Okay, I didn't have to collect original data on that for my purposes. Then we move on to market reform. Market reform I have in red because it varies in the region. So you have some countries in the region have undertaken market reform and other countries haven't. And the cases I'm looking at are Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, and also Uzbekistan. So Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan have undertaken market reform. The government significantly scaled back from the economy in terms of ending subsidies to industry and individuals, also no longer offering a guarantee of employment. In Uzbekistan, by contrast, especially early on in the independence period, the government managed to maintain the employment guarantee and many of the subsidies. So there definitely wasn't market reform in that country. More recently, the government's had financial trouble living up to those promises. But overall, in the independence period, it's definitely not a market reformer, and those guarantees have been maintained. Now, in all three countries, we've seen a failure to actively develop market-enhancing institutions. So in none of the countries are there credit registries that capture a significant portion of the population, for example, that have data about their credit worthiness. In none of their countries have there been effective anti-monopoly committees. Now, it's not surprising that market-building institutions are absent in Uzbekistan because Uzbekistan hasn't even undertaken market reform. But in a way, it's not surprising that market-building institutions are absent in Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan if we think about the bigger global picture. Because internationally, as market reform has been introduced in different regions of the world, it's really just meant the scaling back of the state. Very little attention has been paid to creating those institutions, the minimal government regulations and infrastructure that are essential for markets to actually operate. Now, the last two parts of the argument, the results, the resource-poor non-state actors and the corruption, are evident from original data I collected in Central Asia. Oh, and I should mention evidence for market reform and lack of effective market-building enhancing institutions comes from international financial institutions reports, so World Bank and things like that. You can get good data. But now turning to the last part, factors, or the results, which are a little trickier, I had to collect my own data. So what data did I collect? Well, from 1994 to 2009, I conducted 266 interviews with average citizens, societal actors such as imams, heads of secular charities, with market actors such as representatives of private banks, and also with government officials. I've also conducted 9 household observations, meaning I've lived with families for extended periods of time and basically watched them make decisions about whether to use a bribe in a certain case, whether to activate a personal connection to solve a problem in a certain case. And in addition to living with the families, I also interviewed them repeatedly. So this fieldwork took place in rural and urban areas of Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan. And I focused on Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan because I was particularly interested in what does happen when the state withdraws. How do people cope? Okay. Now, I also did 3 mass surveys in Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, and Uzbekistan, 1,500 respondents in each country, where I asked them about the problems they're facing in their everyday life and how they were coping. So with this group of data, I'm able to illustrate the causal links in my argument. So let's imagine for a minute that we're farmers in Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan. We're private farmers. We no longer work for a state farm, a sovkhoz, or a collective farm, a kolkhoz. Instead, we're trying to make it on our own. And we're struggling economically. So what do we do? Well, first, we may consider whether if we go to the halls of government, there's a formal assistance program that helps us. And in general, there aren't. We remember, oh yeah, it's no longer the Soviet Union. We're market reformers now. State inputs, state purchases of agricultural goods have largely ended. Subsidies to agriculture have largely ended. So the government, there are no formal, large formal assistance programs from the government that's going to help us. So then we think, okay, well, we're living in a market economy now, so we should go to a market actor. So let's check out the local bank, the private bank. Or it wouldn't be local, sorry. Let's think about the private bank in the provincial capital a ways away from our farm. Then when we go to the private bank, what we find is none of them are willing to lend to agricultural residents because we don't have collateral. Okay. Our property is worth almost nothing because we're in rural areas. Property is only really valuable in major cities in Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan. As a result of Soviet limitations on consumer goods, many of us don't have cars still, so we can't use a car as a collateral. Our farm equipment's from the Soviet era. No bank wants to accept that as collateral because that's not worth very much. They also won't accept land or household goods. So we're stuck. We don't have collateral, so none of the private bank credit programs will apply to us. And I confirmed this by talking to the bankers too. So I went around and I interviewed a lot of bankers about whom will they offer credit to, what are the restrictions on their programs, and it matched up with what the farmers were saying. Okay, so as farmers, we may then go to our village mosque. But we find out from the imam that the mosque has very few resources. People give donations, you know, a few bags of flour once a year. The wealthiest farmers in our region do. But generally, the mosque has few resources. So unlike mosques in many of the Middle Eastern countries that have quite extensive employment programs and credit programs, mosques in Kyrgyzstan and Kazakhstan generally don't. All right, so the mosque wasn't helpful. So then we turn to our extended family. And here there's going to be a split between us, okay? A few of us are going to be fortunate enough to be members of wealthy extended families, families that have really made, have become better off in the market reform era. All right? And just to give you an example of a woman who was part of such an extended family, she was a woman I interviewed in southern Kazakhstan in a village where I lived for a few months. She was an agricultural resident, had lost her job with the Sovkhoz, the state farm, and was trying to figure out how to make it in the new era. And first she, you know, we talked about whom she could turn to in society, and she kind of chuckled when I said, what about the mosque? No, the mosque doesn't have any resources. You know, what about a bank? No, they don't lend to agricultural residents. And she said, well, there is a small credit program through the government. I thought about applying for that. So there are still a few small programs, but very limited in terms of how many people they can serve. And she said, but I found out I would have to give a bribe. And I don't like paying bribes. I'm not going to do that. All my neighbors said, if you try to get money through that program, you really only way you'll be successful is if you get a bribe. You need to provide a bribe. So she was fortunate. She had a wealthy uncle, one of those private farmers who had been very successful. So she decided that when none of these alternatives panned out, she would go to her wealthy uncle and get some money, some credit, in order to survive and try to start a business. Okay. So some of us farmers here would be in that more fortunate situation of having a wealthy extended family or a wealthy member in our extended family. But most of us wouldn't, okay? So what do we do? After our family members say, sorry, we're just as poor as you, we can't help you out, what do? We go back to the government, but we find that there are very few formal assistance programs as we suspected. They can only serve a very small number of people. It's very, very competitive, okay? So what we do is we try to get a competitive edge by offering a bribe or using a personal connection, a relative we may know in government or a former classmate of someone we served with in the military in the past, something like that. And I found this in talking to low-level bureaucrats, particularly ones who were charged with running these very small credit programs, that in fact it was very typical for them to be offered bribes. Okay. I also found out from talking to farmers that they would actually travel to a region that was hours away if they knew someone in that region who was in government and may be able to help them out. So they were definitely using personal connections, even though gasoline was so expensive. So they were paying the price that way, but they were hoping to get some assistance from a government official whom they knew personally. So that's the story of how market reform has had an impact, particularly in rural areas, on average citizens in Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan. Now the situation in Uzbekistan is different because there we haven't had market reform. And this is evident from the survey data. And I have a lot of survey data. I'm just going to present two pieces of it. All right. So what this chart shows us is that foremost in Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan, when average citizens are interacting with the state, they're competing for resources, okay? The state is an arena for competition. Whereas in Uzbekistan, the state is foremost a guarantor of goods and services, okay? It's providing goods and services. People are simply receiving things from the state. And these numbers in this table are percentages of the 1,500 survey respondents in each country. And the question, I asked them a series of questions using a Likert scale, so they had to, everything from strongly disagree to strongly agree were the options. And the series of statements were different possible ways that they may be interacting with the state, okay, but not, I didn't use abstract language. So the questions were along the lines of, you know, do you receive goods, is the state a place where from which you can receive, or can you receive goods and services from government officials, things like that, okay? And this just presents a small number, a small amount of that data. So that's one set of data that illustrates the argument. And then the other piece, what I found from the survey data is that in Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan, people are as likely to turn to government officials for assistance as citizens in Uzbekistan. Now think about this for a minute. Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan are the market reformers, okay? People aren't supposed to be turning to the state anymore. They're supposed to be turning to those private banks. If the market's not working real well, they're supposed to be turning to charities, okay? That's what the market reform ideology says. But in fact, we see as much assistance being sought by people, or as high percentages of survey respondents in Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan seeking assistance as those in Uzbekistan. Now, this data comes from asking survey respondents, first of all, what their everyday problems are, okay? And they were able to list those. Then after that, I asked them to whom they turn to for assistance with their everyday problems. And I gave them a list of 21 possibilities, and then they could add on more as well. Not surprisingly, first they said they just relied on themselves. That was the number one response. They could list multiple responses, or they could give multiple responses. Family came in very high. What was surprising, particularly to observers of Central Asia who've been writing so much about the proliferation of Islamic institutions and charities, is that fewer than 4% of respondents in any of the countries, in most cases it was less than 1% actually, turned to any particular market or societal actor. Okay, so that means fewer than 1% of people, for example, in any of the three countries had turned to a mosque or a religious leader for help in the last year. Okay, so in Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan, when people have to compete for state goods and services, and when there aren't market and societal actors they can rely on for substitute goods and services, what happens is they turn to officials and they use corrupt practices in order to get an edge in that competition. Okay. Now, by looking at Central Asia, I was able to test the impact of market reform. But what I couldn't test was the impact of the market-building institutions, because there was no variation. Across all three countries, there had effective market-building institutions hadn't been developed. So what I did next was I went outside of Central Asia and I looked at all the post-communist countries I could get data on. It was about 24 of them. And in those countries, there's variation in market reform. And there's also variation in whether or not they've created market-building institutions, okay? So there are a few exceptions in the post-communist world of countries that have, in fact, gone against the norm and have created things like credit registries and effective anti-monopoly policies. And I did regression analysis on the data, and what I found was that the stronger market-building institutions are in a country, the less pervasive corruption is. Okay, so I found support for my argument, and particularly for the impact of this factor. Now, I'm still not able to test the part of the argument about the legacy of major state economic intervention. So to do that, I have to move outside of the post-communist world, because generally there's little variation on that throughout the former socialist world. So what I'm working on now is looking at developing countries more broadly and creating a data set. So my expectation there would be in countries where there was no or only a very weak legacy of significant state economic intervention, then I would expect corruption to be lower. Okay, so that's the part I'm still working on. So let me talk finally about the implications of this project for both theory and policy. I said in the beginning that I was creating a new framework for understanding corruption. So to show you how it's new, first let me tell you a little bit about what other scholars have talked about in terms of corruption. So prior work has really been limited to focusing on the state as a source of corruption. And there are two schools of thought here. One school of thought is that the state is overbearing. It's got its fingers in so many pies that there are all these opportunities for government officials to engage in corruption. The state is so involved in the economy, okay? And scholars such as Klitgaard, Theobald, Hagopian, and Azdetella have made this argument. A slight variation on this argument is that market reform itself offers government officials opportunities to engage in corruption. And we see this with the phenomena of nomenklatura privatization in the former Soviet Union, where government officials had opportunities to enrich themselves personally because of their access to state resources as the Soviet Union was collapsing and reforming or changing. And scholars who have made this argument include Sun, Holmes, Hellman, and Kaufman. Now, the second school of thought is kind of the opposite. It says that states promote corruption when they're weak. Okay, so weak state capacity, poor regulatory regimes, poor courts, poor laws make it easier for government officials to engage in corruption. And scholars who have made this argument include Lambsdorff, Lodionova, and Blondeau de Sardin. Now, my criticism of this approach is it provides, by focusing on the state, you're only looking at one side of the exchange. You're ignoring the citizens. What are the citizens' incentives? What's their decision-making like? So as hopefully you saw from my argument and the evidence, my focus is really on average people and their decisions about whether or not to engage in corruption. And also, I'm looking at the role of non-state actors and how citizens are thinking about, can we get the goods and services we need without engaging in corruption by, you know, going to a charity, going to a mosque, or do, in fact, we have to turn to our government officials and offer a bribe, use a personal connection, or promise political support? Now, my second critique of the existing work on corruption is it really focuses only on the country level. So we get these descriptions of how corruption is pervasive in a particular country. But when you actually go to these countries, what you find is that some individuals are likely to engage in corruption a lot, and some don't. So we need to be able to explain that, all right? It's not enough just to look at institutions and culture. Both the institutional arguments and the cultural arguments for corruption treat a whole country as very uniform and ignores the fact that individuals make decisions. And what I found through my research and what was hopefully evident from the argument is those individuals who are part of wealthy extended families have the option of not engaging in corruption, right? And that's what I saw repeatedly in households, in wealthier households, that people were able to avoid giving a bribe, for example, because they had a wealthy relative to turn to who had succeeded in the market economy. All right, so what are the policy implications? Well, first of all, this project suggests that it's not enough to adapt laws or tinker with government officials' incentives by, for example, increasing their salaries. We need to ask whether there are actually alternatives to corruption in a particular society. When we find that there aren't alternatives, there are two things in particular we can do as suggested by this project. One is to boost market-building institutions so that the market can flourish and people can turn to market actors for assistance. Another thing that can be done is to try to convince governments to reduce restrictions on societal actors, okay? So make it easier for charities to operate and that type of thing. So basically, to understand corruption, to reduce corruption, we need to move away from this idea that institutions and culture propel people into corrupt exchanges. And instead, we need to realize that citizens are making decisions and they're weighing options about whether there are, in fact, alternatives to corruption. Thank you for listening. And I look forward to your comments and questions. And you also, if we don't get to all the comments and questions today, or if you think of things later, I'd always appreciate an email because I'll continue to work on the project.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Do you want to field your own questions?
Sure, that's fine.
Are there any questions?
Hopefully.
How are people doing? I mean, you're assuming that they're peasants, but a lot of them are city people employed still, or in new ventures, or still in the government, and so forth. Is their general level of well-being only ensured by chicanery, or can they make a legitimate living?
The situation is much better in urban areas, particularly of Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan. You have, in the context of this argument, the way you can think about it is that you just have more market opportunities, right? You don't have the private banks having those restrictions on lending in rural areas. to give a very concrete example again, homes are worth more in cities, so people are more likely to be able to get credit for business ventures. So the argument holds to some extent in cities, but it's really a story of the difficulties in rural areas. Yeah?
I was hoping you could go into a little bit more detail about the variation in levels of corruption in Central Asia and how you're disentangling that from pre-existing institutions in those states.
Okay. So I'm not, first of all, I should have given this caveat up front or this explanation up front. I'm not arguing that there's no corruption in Uzbekistan, okay? What I'm saying is that because the state, especially earlier in the independence period, was still able and willing to provide basic goods and services, that people didn't need to engage in this petty corruption to get those basic goods and services, okay? In terms of the more abstract question of disentangling this from institutions, I see variation at the level of individuals. So institutions, speaking more technically, are controlled for. Okay, so you look in the same village, and some people are choosing to engage in corruption, and some aren't. All right. So the institutional and cultural explanations can't be defended in that respect. Does that make sense? Go ahead, Yoey.
So what about on the state side? I appreciate the emphasis on the citizen side, but why, surely there's, or maybe not, is there variation in the propensity of a government official to engage in corruption, and why would some accept bribes or ask for bribes and some not?
Yeah. I mean, I don't think the state-focused explanations for corruption are wrong. It's just that they've given only a partial picture. So I haven't investigated the state side myself, but the basic explanations we have are things like, you know, the laws you have on the books can really matter. One thing we've seen a lot of, and this actually wouldn't explain variation because it's so common, often you can serve in multiple government positions at once. Okay, and that encourages corruption in some ways. So you can be head of the regional transportation authority, and also a deputy in the local parliament, in the Kanesh or the Maslahat, and that. So we have these conflicts of interest, which would never be allowed in a lot of Western countries. But those laws have not developed. Actually, I think Medvedev did that in Russia, though. I think they finally have that law in the books in Russia. So laws definitely matter. The evidence is kind of mixed on whether how strong the economic incentive is in terms of being tied up with salary for government officials. There have been some studies that show even if you raise the salaries so that government officials can have a decent standard of living, some of them are still engaging in corruption. Now, that may change over time, a new generation and everything. But that's another thing people have really looked at. Is that somewhat helpful? Two examples enough? Okay. Yeah, in the back.
So if bribing makes states do things that nobody wouldn't, do you think corruption right now is like actually increasing the welfare of the people there? So like stopping corruption would hurt the welfare of the impoverished?
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah, I mean, I think it's definitely a coping mechanism. It's not something that people want to do. People were very clear about that. They were both in recounting their experiences to me and also recounting their own experiences and recounting other people's experiences. So I think it is a way that people have been able to survive the economic challenges, but it's obviously not a long-term solution. It would be better to... as I argued, have the market building institutions so that the market can flourish and have more opportunities for more people. But currently, it's a way that people can survive. Yeah.
When you talked about how they would either give a bribe or utilize a connection, mm-hmm. what was more common and what was more effective to receive like that program, if you gave the bribe or if you had the connection in office?
Yeah, it's interesting. So the people would they would try to use a con- if they had if they didn't if they couldn't rely on family members for the resources directly, And they had to, the first thing they would try is to use a connection, because that's cheaper, okay? There's a reciprocity issue. They have to be willing to reciprocate in the future, but that's generally is cheaper than, you know, turning the money over right away. So people would consider, where do I have personal connections, and try to use those first. The other example I meant, the other phrase I kept using, but I didn't talk about it much, so I'll talk about it now in case people are interested, is this idea of promises of political support, which we would refer to as clientelism. So I promise to vote for you, or I promise to get all my neighbors to vote for you, if you give me a benefit that helps just me now. Okay, so this isn't pork barreling. This isn't you, government official, give a benefit to everybody in my village, like building a new bridge. This is you give me something in particular, then I'll give you my political support. And if I'm a respected individual, possibly I can give you other people's support too. And it was interesting. I saw some of that, some clientelism, but not a whole lot, because of the elections aren't that valuable in these countries, okay? And you see more of it at the national level. Okay, you see more clientelism at the national level. Whereas what I was really looking at, the local level in rural areas, even when you had elected officials, the stakes weren't that high for them, okay? The elections weren't that great for them to win anyway, so there was less clientelism. So personal connections were the most favored, followed by bribes, and then promises of political support or clientelism were less common. Okay.
sense of if you did those mass surveys that you conducted today or right now, if there would be any change in what types of responses you're getting from people?
I think there would be some change because, as I alluded to a couple times in the talk, in Uzbekistan, the government has not been able to provide basic state goods and services recently. I'm sure many of you have read the news reports. People are starting not to get their salaries, whereas government public employees are starting not to get their salaries, whereas, you know, that was the case in Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan earlier in the independence period, and now that's switched. So we've definitely seen change in the countries. I'm not going to do the surveys again, but actually I've thought about doing, you know, I'm really interested in this idea of how people cope when the state's withdrawn from the economy. So I'm interested actually in potentially doing the survey in other places, and a friend of mine and I have talked about doing it in the U.S., sort of with certain populations who might not have access to the state as much. But anyway, so yeah, I think there's been some change in Central Asia, definitely, but I'm interested also in sort of promoting a theoretical framework and providing evidence to support it, if that makes sense. So, but there will be a little current events chapter at the end. So, yeah.
I'm curious. You know, what about the role that's how do you see the role that's played by the sort of bribes that or corruption that doesn't. It's not necessarily linked to sort of getting a private good. I'm thinking of like getting a state good or resource. I'm thinking of like, you know, police harassing people for bribes. Do you feel like that interacts in any systematic way with how individuals go about their own decision making when they're thinking about can I approach the state, you know, with a bribe and have that be successful? Or
yeah, I mean, I think it fits in a way to the sort of the cultural explanation of. This is a culture of corruption, right? So when there's corruption in other areas, and I didn't look at police corruption, I didn't look at corruption in education, in those other areas where it's really common, corruption in healthcare I didn't consider. I really focused on obtaining credit and securing jobs, because those are the things that people said were their biggest problems. But anyway, I think you could make a case that when there's corruption in many different spheres, there is sort of this culture of corruption. So it may be corruption would be more likely to be considered by an individual than if they were living in a different culture where corruption wasn't pervasive. Does that make sense? But it's still. But I'm not willing to say, oh, the cultural explanation is great, because the cultural explanation can't explain why you have individuals making different decisions within the same country, within the same culture. Does that make sense? Okay.
I was wondering, from your experience living with families, are the particularistic tendencies seen as like, would it damage somebody's reputation, or is it just seen as a part of life that people use for survival, like you said?
Yeah, it was interesting because I mean, for as long as I've been working in the former Soviet Union, people have always talked about these issues. Like, it's one of, I'm sure a lot of you had this experience too, it's like one of the favorite kitchen table conversations, right? How hard life is now and how I'm trying to cope. But when I went back to do the research specifically for this project, I think it becomes clear that people aren't eager to engage in corruption. They do see it as a coping mechanism, but they feel bad about it. And some of these families I've known for like 13 years, and I've seen incidences where they've acknowledged to me that they have engaged in corruption. So I don't think they're giving me like the story for the foreigner. I think I know them well enough that I think it's fair to say that if people can avoid using corruption, they will. But they also want to make sure they're economically secure. Does that answer your question?
But will it affect their reputation in society?
Oh, their reputation there.
Yes.
I never saw people brag about it to other people. So I think it's pretty covert. Obviously, the government official's going to know. And there's always a suspicion, right? There's a lot of suspicion. Whenever someone who doesn't look well qualified gets a position, it's assumed corruption is used. But I didn't see any signs that it hurt people's reputation. But people did talk more positively about people who weren't engaging in corruption. They would talk about the strength of someone's character, that person could be taking advantage of others, or, that person didn't get to where he is by using, by paying bribes, as far as we know, and, that's really impressive, that type of thing. So I think it helps people's reputation when they don't use corruption, but it doesn't hurt when they do, if that makes sense. Yeah.
With that, in this area that who do people turn to, with the figure of the fewer than 1% turn to the mosque or religious leader, was that because that's just not who they would turn to or where they would turn, or is it more they know that they didn't have resources anyway, so they wouldn't even bother taking the time to go there?
Yeah, the way people explained it to me was it was more an issue of the mosque doesn't have resources, because I didn't ask leading questions. When I did the in-depth interviews with the people, I would start out with, how has your life changed? What are your problems you face today? And then a lot of times, just by talking about that, just starting there, they would already start to talk about how they tried to resolve those problems. So a lot of that came out anyway. If they didn't mention a particular societal or market actor, then I would prompt them by saying, how about the mosque? And then usually what they would say is they would give the resource explanation. Often they would laugh when I said that too, And it's not surprising when you visit the mosques, you can see they don't have a lot of resources, or at least they're not spending them on the facilities. I don't know if you all are interested, I have some more, I can show you that data, which might be my extra slides. So here's the data for whom people turn to. And you see religious here. So it could have been not just an Islamic institution, but one of the other religions too. So these are percentages of respondents who turned to assistance from these different institutions or individuals in the last year.
But in other parts of the world, they may not turn to the mosque, but they would turn to, for example, Islamic charities.
Right, which is why I said religious.
I didn't say mosque. I think before you said about, you may have said secular charities.
So there was when I used the way it was done in the survey, the charity, there was the idea of charity, and then there was the idea of religious institution. So, and then obviously when I did the in-depth interviews, I could really get into detail. So I asked too whether they were like Islamic groups, right? Because there's all the press about like Hizb ut-Tahrir and everything. So you know, if you haven't been to Central Asia yet, you expect to like go into a village and see like Hizb ut-Tahrir, passing out bags of flour or something. And in some parts of Central Asia, we do have good evidence that that's happening. I shouldn't say in some parts. I should say There are a few villages here and there in Tajikistan and now in southern Kazakhstan, southern Kyrgyzstan, where that's happening. But when you look at the big picture, it's so small.
Mm-hmm. Two questions. One, there are Russians still down there. I assume you did your study, your talk in Russian,
mm-hmm.
interviews and so forth. Are there Russian people in those numbers?
Mm-hmm.
Is their behavior any different than the titular language of you?
Yeah, they can't use personal connections as much, which isn't surprising, right? So if you think about Soviet history, what you have, the Russians who were there because of employment policies under the Soviet Union, the Russians who are in Central Asia, it seems to me, usually about three generations there at most. So a lot of, and then brothers and sisters are sprinkled in, throughout the other parts of the former Soviet Union. So they have very small networks in terms of family, okay? They also, and actually Russians talked to me about this too, so family is usually not an option for the Russians. Another connection that people try to activate is hometown region, right? So in Kyrgyzstan, you know, I'm from Osh, I'm living in Bishkek, can somebody else from who's living in Bishkek and Osh help me? You know, so those hometown connections. Russians don't have that either, right? So many of them still identify, you know, back with, you know, Samara is my hometown, that's where my roots are. So they can't use that connection either. And then in some instances, it's actually an ethnic connection, whereas one Kyrgyz will help out another Kyrgyz, so they can't use that either. So a lot of the connection options are excluded because of Russians' ethnicity. They could potentially still use classmates if they did their higher education in the country where they're living now, and they potentially could also use friends for military service. But overall, the Russians have very few options to use personal connections to get ahead.
And just the other question, have you made any parallels with sort of the history of U.S. patronage networks where it was quite normal to have quite extensive patronage networks and organized politics
yep.
around them?
I have. I talk a little bit about that in the book, that the studies from the U.S. weren't particularly helpful because so much of it is based on political parties. And political parties are so weak in Central Asia, or there's one strong one that's, you know, the president's party, that type of thing. So the dynamics are very different. You do see some similarities. I mean, obviously, like in James Scott's work, talking about the party machines, he talks about economic need and things like that. So there's some connections. But overall, I think it's quite different from the U.S. scene historically because you don't have those party networks in Central Asia.
Yeah. This is right. Your talk raises a lot of questions, and I'm glad that you asked your question about patronage networks, too. So, but I'll try to restrain myself to several points. The first point of fact, inquiring minds want to know, which are the countries that have been creating market-building institutions, like with credit, you know, credit rate, or if it's difficult to find it.
If I have the chart, I can answer,
okay.
Otherwise I can't.
So I was just wondering, you know, are we talking about the Estonians of the world?
Mm-hmm.
Or, wondering if it's any country I have.
No. The only other one hold on here.
I mean, if it's not easy.
That's right. Keep talking. Did you have another question?
Yeah, well,
look,
the other thing is it's related to your use of the word patronage network, and
uh-huh.
I was going to start with the word corruption.
Okay.
And I just wanted to I was looking for a little bit of complexity in terms of what we're using, because you used a neutral term, and I was thinking throughout the talk, where does the United States, you know, fit into all this, or some other countries that I know? And so, you know, but you used a neutral term, patronage network, that's
mm-hmm.
a little bit more analytical, and it's not just this kind of term, corruption, that in a way is this like big, monolithic kind of a painting with a broad brush. And so, you know, the way you were using the word corruption, and what I was wondering is, should we be encouraging ourselves to think
mm-hmm.
of other words, is that it really covers such a wide territory, and a part of your talk was about disclaimers about what you're not covering versus what you're covering. And I was wondering, you know, are we talking, in the case of the three countries you talked about specifically, are we talking about specifically violations of law? Are we talking about latitude that a bureaucrat has to make a decision? You know, many of us have applied for mortgages, and sometimes these days you get turned down for a mortgage, and sometimes you get accepted for a mortgage, and we don't necessarily know whether, you know, it's because, you know, oh, he's a professor, he's probably not going to go bankrupt or lose his job, or is it that, oh, I know who he is or something. Mm-hmm. I don't want to say applying different standards, but, you know, we wouldn't necessarily be talking about it in the same way when we're talking about this country. And so just, and the word corruption just seems so ominous and all-encompassing.
Right.
So I'm just wondering, is it better to use some other kinds of subcategorizations? Like you said, patronage networks.
Right.
So would there be other terms that would be more specific, more analytical, and kind of, you know, less just kind of stereotypical,
right,
in lieu of any other kind of term.
I'll answer that question first. So I do break it down to some extent in the talk and definitely in the book. So I'm talking about very specific practices: bribery, use of personal connections, and promises of political support. And the promises of political support, the technical term we use in political science, is clientelism. I decided as a shortcut to use the term corruption for two reasons. One was people in the region use it as a shortcut. So even when they're talking about the use of personal connections, which for our own understanding of corruption, we may be some cases where we see that as corruption, some cases where we don't, like in our own lives, if you think about that, people would refer to that as corruption, okay?
Even connections, let's say family or other connections that are not necessarily...
If that connection is in government service, and if if you're asking for a favor based on your personal connection, yeah. So there were a couple different ways that I could have defined corruption. You can see how other people have done it. A lot of people look at the laws and they say if it goes against the law of the country, it's corruption. Okay. Another approach is a more cultural approach, which I thought was better, and it's also one that I could take because I did all the field research, so I actually know when people are, you know, what acts they refer to as corruption. The second reason is just because I think the work does shed light on the larger corruption literature. So part of it is just a framing device. But I think I do break it down to the smaller analytical categories. So I think I'm doing what you're saying in that respect. And also I feel comfortable because I'm using the language the people there are using too.
Okay.
And I'm very clear in the book. I didn't make this caveat in the talk, but I can do it now. I'm not passing judgment on the people as to whether corruption is good or bad. I mean, I laid it out in the beginning that we can think of it as useful in terms of coping. We also know there are negative consequences in terms of the societies of these countries. But I'm not passing judgment in writing this up or when I was interviewing people as to, you know, is it a good thing if you, you know, try to use an ethnic tie to get a job, or is it a bad thing?
The framework you've set up, you've kind of got these two conditions and the causal factor leading to the resource permanency actors. And it seems at face value that a simpler story is just that poverty causes the resource poverty, which leads to corruption. And it seems that to really kind of support the causal claims of that framework, you need to have some examples in there where you show that, you know, if I get a state that did not have the legacy of intervention but has the other two things, then we don't get the resource poverty. Or various permutations like that,
right,
to show that.
Which is what I'm trying to do now with the big global data set, which is tough because of the data. Believe it or not, there aren't good data on market reform. There are really good data on market reform in post-communist countries because of the work of the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development. But the only data set I've found is one that was created by a think tank and hasn't been used much, but I'm going to try to use it. The issue about poverty is really interesting. I think it's more complicated than poverty because you can be poor in a society where there are options for getting out of poverty, and you can be poor in a society where there aren't options for getting out of poverty, if that makes sense. And those options are what I'm talking about as alternatives. So I think it is more complex than just poverty alone leads to corruption.
I was thinking more that poverty alone can account for getting to resource poverty of non-state actors. That jump kind of makes sense, because your framework just sort of says that once you get to the resource poor non-state actors,
mm-hmm.
you know, then you're getting the corruption.
Okay. It also says that the state no longer has, or the state doesn't have a social safety net, extensive social safety net. That's the other part, because that's what market reform did in practice, is it dismantled that social safety net, dismantled the extensive welfare. Okay. So I think that's another component. The other thing that I'm looking at that is really interesting is what do government officials say when people show up on their doorsteps? You know, what's the message they give? What's the rhetoric? And they actually really use the rhetoric of market reform, even at the village level. You know, it's your responsibility now. You're not, this is, you know, you can't rely on some dadya in the government. You know, that's the things that people are hearing. And then when I talk to government officials about it too, they would recount to me what they've said to people. So I think there's a rhetoric element to the message that the government's sending them, and that's wrapped up in what market reform requires. But I'll think more about that. I've gotten the poverty question before, but you have a different twist on it, which is helpful. So thank you. Hi, Alexei.
Yeah, I have two questions. One question is that in your framework, if we assume, let's assume that, we know that in late Soviet era, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Uzbekistan already had cases and practices of petty corruption,
mm-hmm.
of petty crime. So no matter whether you had market reform or they failed, you would still have petty corruption now existing.
Mm-hmm.
Even if Soviet Union persisted, let's mm-hmm. say, another 20 years, we would still have that. So then there should be some kind of other experiment, because rights came before
mm-hmm.
the market. That's one question. Another question is that we have, as a result of any reforms, we have winners and losers.
Mm-hmm.
So did winners become winners because of petty corruption? And then they are interested in maintaining status quo, keeping poor. And therefore, we have market economy, but we have a certain kind of market economy in which winners dominate and
mm-hmm.
do not let this perfect competition and
mm-hmm.
cheap credit for all the small businesses and so forth. And so, you know, they could capture the state, or they could make state even, you know, important or irrelevant for any of this.
Mm-hmm.
And so this would be the class explanation rather than searching for effective market building
mm-hmm.
institution.
Okay. Great questions. So let me take the Soviet era question first. So I was really wondering about this too, is what I'm finding just a holdover from the Soviet era. So I asked on the survey for people to talk about the Soviet era too. I asked them the same questions, or many of the same questions about the Soviet era. And what I found is that of the people who are turning to government officials now, 83% in one country, 89% in the other country, Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan, didn't turn to Soviet officials. Okay, so first of all, the evidence to show that it's not a holdover is it's different people engaging in the practice. Even once you take out the people who were children in the Soviet era, okay, when you look just at the adults, it's different people. The other thing is the targets are different, not surprisingly, because the states really changed, right? So in the Soviet era, people would turn to their employers who were part of the state, right? They would also turn to their unions who were part of the state. And that's not surprising, because the employers played the role of passing out the welfare benefits, right? Passing out the goods and services. A very, very small percentage turned to bureaucrats, government officials in the Soviet era, or party officials for that matter. The other thing, the third piece of evidence that this isn't just a holdover from the Soviet era, is that what people are seeking is different. Okay. So now people are seeking jobs, any job at all, basically, money and credit. And in the Soviet era, the focus was more on quality. You know, I can get some job, but I want a better job. Or I can get some cut of meat, but I want a better cut of meat. Okay. So there's a difference in terms of what people are seeking. So different people, different targets, and different goods and services. So it's not just a story of we're seeing the same practices from the Soviet era. In terms of the question about winners and losers, so we've seen a lot of really useful work on this, talking about the big players, right? The oligarchs trying to prevent further reform from happening. So that they don't lose, so that the status quo doesn't change, and they don't lose all the power and resources they've already acquired. And this is out of Joel Hellman's work. Let's think about the little players, the little winners, and the little losers in a village. Okay, what we're seeing is, first of all, these little winners—they're not in discussions with, you know, Nazarbayev, for example, about what the laws should be. They're not lobbyists, okay? Also, the little winners in rural areas or in small towns where they're successful traders, sorry, by little winners I mean successful private farmers in a village or successful traders in a small town. So they're not lobbying, they're not involved in these big decisions about reform or not to reform. Also, we see some evidence that they're trying to help people in the community. So they're actually sharing some of their wealth. There are just so few of them that it's not very effective. But we've actually seen cases in villages where successful private farmers not only are helping their own relatives, but they're also starting to maintain the road that runs through the village, things like that. So not to say that they would prefer the status quo, but they're not actively trying to make sure that there's not reform, and they're also sharing some of their resources.
No, I mean the little losers. Why don't the losers simply rebel and take?
Oh, I asked people about that. Yeah.
Because they can do corruption. They know they break the law. They can all do, and they know there's no police. So they won't be.
Right.
So
right.
They can just go rob or steal or whatever.
Yeah. Okay. The little losers. So sad. So the people in villages and small towns who haven't been successful under market reform, I did ask them, why aren't you rebelling? Not in those terms, but anyway. So there were a number of different reasons given. The main reason given was a cultural reason. You know, we're passive Kyrgyz and Kazakhs. We don't rebel. You know, you hear that a lot. I think the bigger reason was they don't feel like they would have any influence. Actually, people did talk about that too. They would say a lot like, what is the point if we protest in our village? What is the point if I write a letter to Nazarbayev? Like, it's not going to have an impact. So there's the sense of not having any political influence. Also, people didn't talk about this, but as a reason for not protesting, but they did express gratitude about receiving assistance from wealthier members of their community. So they did say positive things about, you know, so-and-so, he's become a successful farmer. We really appreciate it that he plows the road in the village in the winter. You know, so things like that. So that would help explain why they're, you know, not burning the successful farmer's house down at night and things like that. If they perceive, I think those were all the reasons. Okay. Is that helpful, Alexei? Okay.
And if they were French, they would have rebelled.
Yeah.
If there's no other questions, then let's thank Professor McMahon again. And thank you.